From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
To say that the first year of Governor Mike Parson's first full-year term has been challenging would be an understatement. He's had to deal with the continued presence of the COVID-19 pandemic throughout the state, as well as a big decision from the Missouri Supreme Court on Medicaid expansion and the pressures of an active legislative session. Parson spoke with me last Thursday in his office in Jefferson City about tackling these tough issues, as well as Missouri's 200th anniversary as a state. That's coming up next on a special edition of Politically Speaking.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
Hi, everybody. This is Jason Rosenbaum, a political correspondent for St. Louis Public Radio. What you're about to hear is an interview I conducted with Governor Mike Parson in his office in Jefferson City. We spoke on Thursday, July 29th, about a multitude of issues, most notably the COVID-19 pandemic. I started off the conversation like this. During a speech in Springfield on July 27th, you said, and I quote, "There was no playbook that you could turn around and say, this is what you do in a crisis like this. We, all of us, you today, we had to figure out what was the best path forward for Missouri." And you went on to say, "I think when this is all said and done, we're going to look back and say we did a pretty good job here in Missouri taking care of business and taking care of the people in our state by working together." Why do you think your administration has done a good job in combating the COVID-19 pandemic?
Right. I think, one, because we stayed true with the four pillars that we started out with the things that we talked about, PPE, hospitalization, data, all the things that was necessary for us to move forward. And we never left those four basic principles. I think the other thing we did, looking back on the first 18 months, when there was so much uncertainty, as we look back on that previous to the Delta variant, we knew we were on the right track in the state of Missouri. And if you compare the way we handled our state versus other states that did more restrictions, that did more mandates, and you really realize that we were doing a better job than what they were. And I think those are the things that will be the test of time to see who reacted right. But you know, back in those days, everybody's just trying to do what was best for the people of Missouri. And I didn't fault anybody for different things that they were doing. You know, basically, we had to let people make some decisions on their own, and we had to trust them to make the right decisions.
So, as you know, right now, Southwest Missouri is in a particularly dire position. There's reports of hospitals running out of capacity, and I think we all know the real culprit here is the low vaccination rates, not necessarily in Springfield, but especially the surrounding counties around Springfield. What is the state doing to bring these numbers up?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think it's important to point out when the vaccine first came out in December and January, we knew at that time, everyone knew in the state, the healthcare industry, that there was going to be a hesitancy of vaccination between a certain amount of the population, and we thought that was going to be around 45%. So all this is coming true. I think it's also important to realize that vaccines have only been available to all general public for 4 months. You know, we've never had the ability to be able to do that. So we knew we're at this point now where we were going to be this hesitancy. So that's why we did a $5 million marketing campaign in the state of Missouri, trying to encourage people to do it, trying to make vaccine where it's readily available, that where actually people walk past it every day, no matter where you're at, no matter whether you're in rural Missouri, urban Missouri, you have the availability of vaccine, whether it's the doctor's office, whether it's the pharmacies, whether it's department stores, whether it's grocery stores, we have the ability to be able to do that. We did the incentive program here, trying to move the needle on that, to trying to say, hey, does this really work or does it not?
And you weren't a fan of incentive programs. You told me that, but you decided to go through with that anyways. Why did you decide to do that?
Well, again, we're trying to move those numbers up, and the Delta variant changed the game plan. And that's why I say you have to be so flexible in this to be able to move. But when that Delta variant started coming up and we seen that the people that were at the most risk. So that was a tool we had. We put it out there, and it worked. I mean, there's been very good success with that. I think we've had over 250,000 people sign up, you know, for the programs we have. But more importantly, we went from about 5,000 vaccines a day in the state of Missouri to probably now we're up to somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000. So it's changing the needle.
Now, so both you and Senator Roy Blunt have said that once people, especially in smaller towns, start realizing that the Delta variant is real when it starts infecting their families, their loved ones, or themselves, that could be the best incentive for people to get vaccinated. But I recall even you said it's really unfortunate that we have to get to that point before people start taking this seriously. What have you heard the reasonings behind why people are hesitant to get vaccinated?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I agree with what the senator said and what I said too. You hate to see that hesitancy, but I think it's all the rhetoric you hear. I think people don't know who to trust, who to believe. You know, there's been so much propaganda put out there, both politically, both media driven. And I think people are sitting out there, do they believe in this or not? It's why we've really tried to really encourage people to talk to their healthcare workers in their hometowns. Talk to your doctor, talk to a nurse, you know, talk to your clergy, talk to people that's kind of in the know on this, and then make a decision. And those are the things that I think really move the needle. And just what you said, I think we all realize now in our communities, no matter where you live in Missouri, you're knowing somebody that's been affected by this. And we realize who it's affecting now. And I think it's so important for the people to understand, when we went after the most vulnerable in the beginning, 65 and older, the ones at the highest risk, we know the vaccine worked. We're seeing it work every day. So now we're trying to encourage that next group of people, that 40 to 65, you know, all those age brackets to get the vaccine. So we just got to keep pushing hard every day to make sure that people understand the truth and they understand how important this vaccine is.
There's no question that Democratic areas like St. Louis and St. Louis County have large amounts of people that are unvaccinated. So I want to make that clear before I ask this next question.
Right.
You look at the counties with the lowest percentages, they're largely rural counties, and they're largely counties that voted for people like you and Roy Blunt and Josh Hawley.
Right.
So I want to ask you, what responsibility do you think Republicans who lead state government here have to not feed into the misinformation and the propaganda that I think a lot of people don't want to see exacerbated during this crisis?
I think we have the obligation to be honest with people. And I don't care whether you live in St. Louis or you live in Douglas County. You know, people are people. People have a right to have all the information we can put in front of them, all the availability we have to give them a vaccine. It's why in St. Louis, for example, I remember partnering with the Urban League early on and the outreach we knew. And we knew he was going to partner with churches in St. Louis and Kansas City. And how do we reach people? But those same type of people, those same churches, those same leaders in rural Missouri are just important. But I don't think this is the problem we have with this. We're trying to declare Republican, Democrat, philosophies and stuff. This philosophy should be making people get the best information. We give them the most accurate information and make sure to try to help them, guide them to the vaccine if they so choose.
So over the weekend, I got a call from a Washington Post reporter named Dan Diamond, and he was asking me about the political response to the Delta variant surge. And I pointed out that high-end leaders like you, Roy Blunt, Josh Hawley are all saying, get the vaccine, I've gotten the vaccine, you know, it's safe, it's effective. When you go down the line to like the state legislative level, it's a little bit different. There are some legislators who are, you know, putting out this insane ideas that these vaccines have microchips in them, or it's genetic engineering. And what I told Mr. Diamond was, I don't think that they would be saying that if their constituents weren't thinking that too.
Yeah.
Is there a certain point where politicians can only do so much, but when you run into that sort of conspiratorial, hard-headed thinking, you're going to run into a wall about getting people vaccinated?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't necessarily agree that I think everyone's like that. I think that's a very small minority of people that's like that.
Yes.
But I will say this too, Jason. I think the reality of it is we have to face the fact that there is going to be a certain segment of the population that's not going to take this vaccine for whatever reason. Some, whether maybe it's Christian values, maybe it's some other reasons they have it. Maybe women decide for some reason what they've heard or read, they don't think so. Again, I'm going to go back to what I said. When people like myself as governor, we have a leadership responsibility to encourage people what we think is the best thing to do for them, for the safety of them. The one thing that we should be is the safety and health of the people of our state. For me, I believe the vaccine works. I don't know what the outcome of the vaccine is going to be 3 or 4 years from now. Nobody does. But I think for the time we're in right now, if you want to save lives, I think the vaccine is definitely the way to do that.
Now, this is actually a question that my wife wanted to answer. As you know, our spouses are much better than us, and they're often often
most
smarter.
Certainly. Most certainly.
Often smarter. She pointed out that there could be some people who are hesitant to get the vaccine because they may work at, you know, minimum wage or gig economy jobs, and they're worried that if they get the vaccine, there's going to be side effects, and they're going to have to take a day or two off, and that's going to threaten their livelihood. Is there anything state government can do to provide some sort of incentive for businesses to give paid time off? So if that happens, they have some of those people who I think are clearly gettable people will go and get the vaccine.
Yeah. I hope all businesses would be pretty understanding about that. And I think they are. A lot of businesses are stepped forward doing the right thing. But I also think people have those benefits in there, whether it's healthcare, whether it's taking a shot for COVID-19 or any other health issue. I think there's things in place for that. But again, I go back to what I'm saying all along. I think we got to give the people the tools they need to get the vaccine, and whatever that means, making it convenient to them. And I've said this all along because there's been political bias on both sides of this. If somebody wants a vaccine in the state of Missouri, and if they can't get to it, we'll take it to them. If they literally, all they got to do is call the health department, call the state, we'll make sure they get a vaccine. And I think that's how you encourage them. But what reaction to people with a vaccine has, we don't know that. We don't know what, and let's be honest with you, we don't know what this is going to look like 6 months from now, a year from now, or 5 years from now. So, and this vaccine, which I believe in it, I think people should take it, but it's not been approved yet. You know, so there's a lot of variables to this. Just give people the facts, be honest with them, tell them the truth, let them make the decision. I think they'll make the right
one. Do you think that one of the hesitancies is once it's not fully approved, and then once it's fully approved, not only will people go and get it, but businesses and institutions will start mandating it? And this gets to another question. Are you going to support anything from a state government level that's going to prevent private entities from mandating the vaccine?
Well, first of all, we won't mandate anything from the governor's office to be able to do that. The private sector is the private sector. I think it's always a tough decision to do that balancing act. Do you require somebody in private business and own their own business to tell them whether they can do a mandated vaccine or not? So far, we're not going to go down that road. If that business decides they want to do that, you know, we're going to allow them to do that in this state till something changes to show us different. You know, but I would also point out, it's like the healthcare industry right now. There is a shortage of healthcare workers right now. I think the last thing in the world you want is somebody that's been on the front lines for 18, 19 months that's dealt with this and been dealing with that. Do we want to lose any healthcare workers over a mandated vaccine? So, and there is some hesitancy within them, within their organizations, to be able to do that also. So again, I'm going to go back. We want to get as many people as we can to be able to make sure they're safe as we can.
So you put out a public statement against the St. Louis and St. Louis County reimposing mass mandates. First of all, that's true. I just want to make that clear.
Most certainly. Yeah. That is correct.
So we could discuss mandates, whether they can actually be enforced. I think we've talked about that before. And I think that is definitely a problem with mass mandates. But I want to read a quote from Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner under President Trump, and a fairly respected voice in the COVID-19 discourse. And he said, I quote, "If you live in a high prevalence area, the advice I've been giving people is, if you're taking care of young children or people who might be vulnerable, you should be mindful of that even if you're vaccinated," and suggested that mask wearing in places like Missouri may be prudent. I'm talking about voluntary mask wearing.
Right.
So my question is, take aside the question of whether masks should be mandatory, would you recommend that Missourians wear masks right now, given that the Delta variant spread? And I'm talking about in indoor public places. Like right now, me and you are talking without a mask because we're both vaccinated.
Right.
But I'm talking about if you go into a grocery store at all, would you recommend that people voluntarily wear masks?
I think that's strictly up to them. We've always said that all along, that to prevent this, is the mask is part of the prevention of it. But again, I think what you're trying to do is encourage people to take the many safety precautions they can for themselves and their family. I think that's where it comes down to. I think whether they do or not, they have to make that choice. I'm not convinced the mask mandates work. I'll just be honest with you, but I'm not saying they do or they don't. I'm saying if you compare it to other states that had the lockdowns, that had the mask mandates, and you look at the states that didn't, There's no difference. There's not a state out there you can point to that did all the mandates. It's in better shape than some of us that did not. Again, I respect the local levels. I've always said that. I think what happened in St. Louis County with Sam Page up there, or what happened up there, why would you even want to make that decision without the input of a council that represents the people of that area? That's the thing that worries me when we have, regardless, any one person makes those decisions by themselves. I think as whether it's the governor, whether it's a mayor, whether it's a county executive, you got to be real careful how you use your power sometimes to make sure that you are doing what the will of the people want. So I would kind of disappointed the way that all come out. And then we've seen at the end of the day, the people didn't agree with that.
I want to talk about some of your tweets about the whole issue of door-to-door vaccinations. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, President Biden's administration probably saw those and they would say, we're not going door-to-door forcibly vaccinating people. We want to partner with organizations that are going to provide information to folks. And, you know rural Missouri better than I. I don't want to patronize you just by saying because I go to a lot of state parks in rural Missouri. I know rural Missouri. But rural Missouri is really spaced out, and I could see a need for either people going door to door with information about the vaccines, or if they want to get the vaccines at their house and voluntarily, that could really be very helpful for people. So can you just kind of address this? Because it seems like there's conflicting viewpoints on what's actually going on here and the value of door to door vaccinations or information in rural Missouri.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think when the president made that statement, it wasn't a very clear statement at all. He didn't say what he meant by going to a door-to-door campaign. So I think, again, that's the confusing part of that when you just come out and say a statement and there's not a plan with it. I think that when you talk about door-to-door, we've been doing that for 18 months with our health centers in our states. Mm-hmm. We've been doing that with the Urban League. We've been doing it with the clergy, about taking vaccine to somebody or making sure they get to a vaccine. So I don't think that was any new concept of what we are doing on the local levels, and I'm not for sure why you need the federal government to come in and say we're going to do a door-to-door campaign when you can do that now on the local levels, which we are doing now. And I think that's important. But I also think you got to realize the reality of going door-to-door in rural Missouri. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody that's kind of been down those roads, mm-hmm. that is a very difficult job to do, and people don't know who everybody is, and you know, It's like you're going into territory that you probably don't belong in the first place. And if you're wanting to go there to encourage people, those people have access to public information all the time. Mm-hmm. You know?
Before we shift to Medicaid expansion, I want to just bring this final question in about where we are right now. So I was talking with Senator Lincoln Huff on Politically Speaking and how people like me have basically done everything that was asked to us for the last 18 months. I didn't see my family because they live out of state. I missed weddings and other celebrations. I mean, my son didn't go to in-person school until April 26th.
Right.
And I wasn't happy about it, but I understood the reason why, because the vaccine wasn't widely available. And now we're seeing the prospect and the fear of restrictions coming back. And from my perspective, it's because a lot of people aren't getting vaccinated. The spread is primarily from people, and the severity especially, is from people that are unvaccinated. So can you understand why people like me who have tried to do everything the right way are a little upset that a lot of Missourians aren't doing the right thing and threatening our normalcy for everybody else?
Well, I think we want them to do the right thing. I don't know that you're upset because somebody chooses to do something, because I don't know what their convictions are about choosing
sure.
whether they do that.
And,
I'm not going to blame them.
Before you answer, I think that there are definitely genuine reasons for vaccine hesitancy that we also talked on the show.
Right.
If somebody
right.
got a medication when they were younger and it went bad, they're not going to be as trusting to the medical establishment. And also, you know, Black Missourians have been let down by doctors in the medical profession for decades. So
well,
I want to make that clear, and also buttress your earlier point that it's not just microchips and nonsense. There's real reasons for vaccine hesitancy, but continue, Governor.
Yeah, well, and I think you've got to point out what the real science, what the real truth is. Last year, 85% of the kids in this state went back to a classroom setting, pre-vaccine, so that, and without incident. You know, the main thing we were worried about last time, we were worried about teachers, we were worried about the cooks, the janitors, everybody in the administration, that older bracket. And we didn't have no issues with that. Now, all of a sudden, we do have a vaccine. We've got a large number of the population that has been vaccinated, the most vulnerable people. And now we're almost going back to stricter regulations than we had then. I'm telling you, if these kids are not in school, I think the other issues we have to deal with, the mental health issues, the poverty issues, the special needs kids, we are absolutely creating another set of problems that are yet to be foreseen. So I think the best place for those kids can be is in a safe classroom setting, and I think there's a way to do that. But again, the people in those local areas know how to do that.
Let's talk about Medicaid expansion. The Supreme Court ruled earlier in July that the 2020 ballot item is valid, and the state has to start signing people up. When that will happen is up in the air. There still has to be a ruling by the Cole County judge. But most lawyers I've talked with, and some of them admittingly were involved in this case, say it's no longer a question of whether Medicaid expansion will happen, and it's now shifted to when. What happens next with Medicaid expansion?
Well, we're definitely making plans to see how we move forward both ways. We realize what the dynamics of this are. First of all, the Supreme Court was a unanimous decision, you know, and it depends on what this judge does here in Cole County. But I think the other thing is you got to start preparing both ways. Now, the problem we have, as you've well, I think, pointed out, we don't have the funding ability to be able to fund it right now, to have the spending authority to be able to do that. And that's just a reality of it. So that has to change some way to do it. What we don't want, what I really don't want, is some judge deciding for us how we're going to implement this, you know, from an area that he has no experience in. And the other thing, if we do have to implement it, if we do, I don't want to be in the position where we lose that 90% match from the federal government. And that's a reality, because if they order us to pay, then that means we pay out a general revenue and taxpayer money here in Missouri.
Has your administration submitted the necessary documentation to the federal government to start the ball rolling on Medicaid expansion?
We're working on that right now. General counsel and all of them are seeing what prepared. But we really cannot until we find out, do we have the ability to do that, you know, to be able to do that process. But we're working on knowing what we got to sign up for these people. We know how that system's going to look like. So we've been prepared for that for some time.
So this is a little bit in the weeds, but when I was talking with Senator Bob Onder, he proposed the idea of calling the legislature back into special session and having the legislature say no money is going to the expansion population. Now, first of all, I don't think that they can do that. I've talked to lawyers who say if you try to do that, that runs afoul to other Supreme Court decisions. But let's take that aside. That only works if you call them into special session. Would you even consider doing that right now?
We're not going to call anybody into special session until we have a solution. And if there's no solution to be had, we're going to publicly go out here and say there is no solution to have. But to kick that over to a single judge to make that decision for the people of Missouri is not what you want. That is not a good road to go down. It may sound great politically out there, but the reality of it is you could definitely lose that battle and be in a worse situation than we are today sitting here talking.
Yeah, and the reason I ask that is, like, if you don't call a special session now, and the Cole County judge says people can start signing up on August 11th, and they do, and then you pull the funding away, you're literally kicking people off of Medicaid after they've signed up. And I don't know if you want to be in that situation, but you saw what happened in 2005 with your former governor, Matt Blunt. That caused a lot of pain with people and also a lot of political blowback. I take it you don't want that to happen either.
Yeah, most certainly. I was here during that time. And in this particular instance, it's even worse because now you're talking about able-bodied adults. Mm-hmm. And are you going to take somebody that's disabled off the system? Are you going to take somebody else that has health issues off of that for an able-bodied adult? I don't think anybody wants that. But that's the road you could possibly be going down if there is no additional funding.
So a lot of Republicans, including yourself, have talked about the long-term cost of Medicaid expansion. I think one of the benefits the state has, first of all, we have a large surplus. And second of all, you're going to get $1 billion from the American Rescue Plan after Medicaid expansion happens. So you have some time to basically pay for the state match and then maybe come up with a permanent funding solution if there is a state match. There's been some people that say you can rearrange who is in the 90-10 pool from the existing 60-40 pool, and the state match could be negligible. But let's just say there is a state match. Would that be what you think legislators should start doing, just preparing for that inevitability, even if it's 5, 6, 7 years down the road?
I most certainly think you should look at everything on the table and figure out where you're going to be able to do this. You know, I think there's no question if you don't have the federal matching money, you know, regardless, we might have a surplus today, but you can't make a decision on what you have today. Mm-hmm. That's one thing I'm learning from governors from this position, and that's what always gets us in trouble because we have a tendency to think everything a year at a time. You got to be thinking, what is this going to look like 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and what is the cost of that going to be? You're not always going to have a surplus. We always know that in government history, so you got to be able to deal with that, but you got to be prepared on both fronts.
So before we shift to general legislative topics, I want to go back to what you said about the authority. Because I think I know what you're talking about. When I was talking with Chuck Hatfield, and I showed him your statement, Kelly, I'm gesturing to your spokeswoman, Kelly Jones, for our listeners. He thought that you meant that the legislature is going to need to specifically say that your administration can spend the federal money that is going to come with the 90-10 match, which you don't have right now.
That's correct.
And you're also going to have to eventually put more money into the program to make sure that Medicaid doesn't run out of money, and then doctors and hospitals don't get reimbursed for any Medicaid patients, which I'm sure you certainly don't want to happen, because that would spark an unmitigated crisis in the state. So I want to make sure that my assumptions are correct on both of those fronts.
Exactly. We just don't have the spending authority to do that. We don't have it if we wanted to. And again, you don't want to lose that matching authority to be able to do that. And regardless, you got to come up with the 10%, but you got to have the ability to do that. We don't have that right now because the legislators didn't fund that. And in fairness to the legislators, they have every right to do that. That's part of the system of the way that occurred. We just got to say, okay, after this Supreme Court ruling, are we willing to say that we're not going to move forward, or are we not? And at some point, they got to make that decision.
So I'm going to talk about a potpourri of other legislative topics. All right. Let's talk about the gas tax increase. That, I think, was something you've been pushing for a long time. What do you think the impact of it is going to be on the state?
I think it's going to be huge for the state of Missouri. And I think if we can build on what we're doing now, as you've seen since I become governor, those two priorities of mine was infrastructure and workforce development. By making those a priority, we've seen how fast our state has grown, how we're moving forward on the economic levels. We're in the top 10 on several different categories in the state right now, where we never was in those before. But if you don't have the infrastructure in place to support businesses, new businesses, and for people to come to this state, we're kidding ourselves if we're going to grow. You got to have the workforce development in there. So the infrastructure piece was good. One of the things that I really liked about it, because it was so divided in the state on that issue, is about a 50-50 decision, and we all know how that worked out. But you have the option now to opt out of that. And that's not a complicated option whatsoever. Farmers like myself have been doing this for years with off-road diesel. It's a one-page form you fill out. You get your money back if you don't want to do it. But I think the vast majority of Missourians will do their part to help the state on infrastructure. It's the one thing the constitutional requirement tells us to do.
What do you think from some of your Republican brethren or colleagues that think this is a betrayal of conservative principles? Because I'm sure you've heard that, but I feel like you deserve a chance to respond to that.
I think that's why we put the option in it. We for people that are dead set against that and understand it, but I also think it's up to the legislature sometime to make tough decisions and to cast votes one way or the other. I think it's come too easy anymore when legislators do not want to make tough decisions. They say, well, let's kick this to a ballot initiative and let them decide. Well, sometimes that's what happens.
So another bill you signed into law was a wide-ranging law enforcement bill that includes ban on chokeholds, putting use of force incidents into a police database, also getting rid of the residency requirement for the Kansas City Police Department. I've been following this type of legislation since Michael Brown was shot and killed in 2014. As you know, because you were in the legislature then, it's been extraordinarily difficult to get any sort of movement here in Missouri on what I like to colloquially call police accountability issues. But this passed overwhelmingly. You had police groups working with people that were more aligned with, like, the quote-unquote protester movement. This would seem to be a real example of bipartisanship and differing interests working together. What do you think the impact is going to be on especially African-American perception of police after this goes into effect?
Yeah, I think a lot of things to do that. I hope the African-American community realizes that we were listening, number one. I think that's one thing. I've spent a lot of time in St. Louis and Kansas City with a lot of agencies up there in the African-American community. And I think they've had a lot of lip service, to be right honest about it, for decades and decades about this issue. I think maybe because of the experience I have in law enforcement, maybe it's some guy that can kind of get there and says, hey, we got to change the way things we're doing. I think it was an advantage. But I think the reality of it is it's okay to change. Law enforcement's not perfect, of what we do. And change is good sometimes. And I think that was a perfect example of some things we can do to team up. I think Lincoln University being the first African-American college to have a law enforcement academy was huge. I think that's how we get diversity within our ranks, how we get people in those arenas. And, I think as long as we're talking about this, I think the possibility of going back to community policing, having that conversation even more on the state level to figure out how we can help with that for St. Louis, Kansas City, some of these high crime rate areas, especially on the violent crime, we've kind of opened the door for future ways to do things better. And that's a good thing.
you know, you've been pretty outspoken that you're not a fan of the concept of defunding the police, which I'm just going to define as cutting the police budget and taking that money and putting it towards social service entities or endeavors. But, you know, in St. Louis and St. Louis County, we've passed really sizable sales taxes in 2017 that didn't all go to police, but a lot of it did go to police. And as a resident of St. Louis County, the St. Louis region, crime is still bad. And it kind of shows that just pouring more money to police is not necessarily a solution. So why not let some people like St. Louis Mayor Tishara Jones try something different when the opposite really wasn't working?
Why do you need to do one or the other? Why do you not do both? Which is exactly what we did when we started putting funding in for St. Louis, the Urban League, on the de-escalation teams that were sent out there, basically on a social worker's role to be able to do that. I think those are the things that are important you do. I don't think it's one or the other type of solution. Mm-hmm. I think you need them both. I think you need more police officers out there. I, however, do think police officers need to go more back to community policing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we've did of technology is we probably give every officer a reason maybe to stay in a car more than ever, because you can do everything now in a car, reports yeah. and everything else. And I think we need to have more people in the community. I think you need both. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's one or the other. I think there's a way to do both.
One thing that did not happen, there was an effort to pass an elections bill that reinstated Missouri's government-issued photo ID requirement and also would have put in place a no-excuse absentee in-person voting system. Do you think that that's something that can be done next year? I know the Democrats don't like the idea of photo ID, but I think that they may be willing to let it pass if it's paired with the getting rid of the excuse system for absentee ballots.
Yeah, I think the quick version, maybe the quick answer to that is, you know, I think voter ID is important. I think the vast majority of people in the country believe. I think 70% of the people believe in voter ID. And I think it's disappointing we didn't get that done last year, because I think that should have been a priority last year to be able to do it with everything going on in the country. But I also want to point out, too, Jason, the vast majority of our election officials in this state get it right.
Yeah.
Year after year after year, all the controversials you hear, all the discussions you hear about everywhere else doesn't happen here, because we do a good job of running our elections here. But I firmly believe that voter ID should be in place. People should be able to identify themselves to vote.
Do you support the idea of having a runoff system for U.S. Senate, congressional, or statewide offices?
I don't know any reason right now to change the system we got. Again, the system works. Maybe it doesn't always make us happy the way that the campaigns are running and stuff, but for years this thing has stood the time, decade after decade. I'm not a big fan of changing anything if it's not talking.
Honestly, Governor, it really seems like that was presented because people are scared your predecessor is going to win the U.S. Senate primary, and it seems like if you really want to do that, just beat him in an election and not change the system. I mean, that is an actual opinion, but do you agree with that?
Yeah, you know what? Look, you know, I don't think you change the election process because you don't like the outcome of the election because you didn't win on the vote. You know, I think that's where we all got to go back to doing a better job and support our candidates, support who people in believe who we believe. That's democracy at its best. Yeah. I mean, either way that goes, there's consequences to elections. We're seeing that now in some of the things we've been talking about today.
So I know we've talked about in the past, when you were lieutenant governor, you specifically said you were not in favor of legalizing marijuana for recreational use. And I understand the reasoning for that, but it's looking like there's going to be a ballot initiative. And if it's a ballot initiative that's well organized, it'll probably pass. And I know that kind of goes against what you said before, but would it make sense for the legislature to pass recreational marijuana legalization on its own so it has a say of where that money goes and how the industry is regulated?
Well, I would much rather legislators have that discussion out here and see if there is a solution to have one way or the other than doing the ballot initiative, because we know even the last time we did that with the medical marijuana that created issues too, both good and bad, to try to administer it. And, you know, I haven't changed my opinion on that. I probably agree with you. If it got on a ballot, it's probably going to pass. But I think it's important right now. We just really need to get what we got in place to make sure we've got everything in place that to run the thing that we have right now. And I think we are in the process of that. So we'll just have to see how that comes out. But again, I think that's the reason people get sent up to the legislative branches. You get sent up here. Yeah. To make tough decisions. But when you don't make decisions, that's why these ballot initiatives kick in.
$2.8 billion coming from the American Rescue Plan. You're going to have a big say over where that money goes. I mean, the legislature is going to appropriate it, but if you don't like it, you can say, I'm vetoing this. I want it to go elsewhere. I've heard things like fixing the IT system. Probably some of that money could go for sewer, lead pipe removal, rural broadband. What are some ideas you want that money to go, because that could be a real generational change for the state.
The vast majority of things that we'll be looking at, Jason, is long term. What are we going to do on infrastructure? Some of the things, how are we going to build a brand new health department out of this? Can we get a state of the art health department out of this after what we've all been through with these crises? How do we really move the state forward? But more importantly, how do we move the cities and the counties forward also? How do we partner with them to make sure? Look, the last thing in the world we want to do is just waste this money or just do a giveaway program that 2 to 3 years from now, 5 years from now, whoever the next governor is sits here and says, hey, what happened to that $2.8 billion? We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
So I'm sure you're paying attention to D.C. now about the infrastructure deal, which I think is going to be changing a lot. But a lot of it could go for roads, bridges, public transit, things that could be on top of that $2.8 billion. If that ends up passing, which right now it's looking decent, what would you want Missouri to get out of that bill?
I hope we get just what a transportation bill is all about, just the things you name: transportation, bridges, highways, airports, trains, river ports. I think broadband, how do you really make sure it goes to infrastructure on that? Well, you know, Washington, D.C., who knows what all is going to be in this bill when it comes out. But if it's a transportation bill, you would like to think that the vast majority of it deals with transportation.
Now, I'm going to shift to your favorite subject, the bicentennial, after this question.
Okay,
I promise.
Right, good. That'll be a little more fun.
We're going to get into the fun stuff. But, you know, it was interesting watching this legislative session unfold. I think there's no doubt it was up. There was a lot of things that ended up getting accomplished. It wasn't always pretty, though. I saw some real tension between you and the House leadership at times, and real tension between you and the Senate leadership near the end. It was like, you, at the beginning, you and Rob Vescovo were hated enemies, and by the end, you were probably like, thank you for passing my gas tax bill, and the Senate, you're screwing up the FRA. So what's kind of your relationship with the legislature? I know that was a big priority of yours to improve the working relationship. It seems like you had a lot of output, but sometimes it got rocky this year.
Well, it's always going to be rocky when the governor's office and the legislature's. Look, one thing I want to point out to you, when you said that the hate relationship, you know, in my career, I'm beyond hatred. I'm just not one of those guys that do that. I'm always a guy finding solutions. And look, it's tough. You got to be willing to stand your ground for sometimes and stand up for what you believe in. And that's exactly what did. And sometimes even to the governor, it's frustrating when you see all the bureaucracy and all the political things get played out when you're saying, wait a minute, what's really the best thing for the people? So you try to rein everybody back in and say, hey, this is what we need to be doing. But, this job's not a cakewalk.
Yeah.
You know, you got to fight your battles. And we won our battles, so that's the good thing.
So it is the 200th anniversary of Missouri. Now, Missouri, by literal definition, is a political subdivision of the United States. It's a state. But if you had to describe what Missouri means to the rest of the country, how would you do it?
I think it's the heart and soul of the country. I really think Missouri values have spread all over this nation. And if you look at 200 years where some of the people that come out of Missouri, the Mark Twains, the Walt Disneys, the General Pershings, you know, the Hubble telescope, all the creators that come from our
state. Champ Clark.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. There we go. And then you have.
Should have been president.
Yeah.
But you, continue.
But you have all these people in our state's history, and you look at the impact they've had on the nation. You know, coming from Missouri, but I think it goes back to basic. And if you listen and you read stories about all these people, it comes back to Missouri values, hard work, being good neighbors, treating people with each other, giving each other a helping hand when they need it. Those fundamental principles is what makes this 200th anniversary so special. And I'll be honest with you, we're doing the same thing today. The waters may get muddy sometimes, but I guarantee you Missouri will.
Well, that was going to be my question. I mean, I'm going to tell you an anecdote about when I first decided to move to Missouri. I was interviewing at a newspaper in Crystal Lake, Illinois, and I said that I had gone to the University of Missouri-Columbia, and I was thinking of taking a newspaper job at the Columbia Tribune. And one of the reporters said, wow, I don't know why you'd want to go to Missouri. It's such a poor state compared to Illinois, which I think there's some snobbery involved with it. But the reality is, in some parts of the country, people look down on Missouri as this poverty-stricken, backward state. After Ferguson, there was the whole issue of racism here. The reputation could be better. And I may ask you, I'm sure you don't agree with all of those perceptions, but how, as governor, do you want to improve the perception of the state
Yeah, first of all, I don't think it's a fair comparison between Illinois and Missouri because we win that hands down. So somebody, let me declare that to you right now off of that. Now, there'll be a lot of people calling in about your show about that on the East St. Louis side. But let me just say this. I think for all of us in this state, as we move forward, where we've been, it's not about which states are better. It's about taking care of your own state within the borders of your state, doing what's right. And I think Missouri has done that. I think, like you said, I think originally people used to think we're flyby country. We've heard that so much. I'm tired of hearing it. But with Ferguson, the good and the bad of Ferguson. But people have put a bigger spotlight on Missouri. People do realize there's more to Missouri than just that. You know, when you be able to get to, and people are starting to see the positive side of Missouri, why it's important to do business here, why we've grown $2 billion in the middle of a pandemic on a business expansions, why we're seventh in the United States for people wanting to come to our state right now. It's because we have a lot to offer for businesses and everyday people, and they want that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, I did a podcast recently with one of your former colleagues, former State Representative Stephen Weber, and he asked me, like, you know, what are some of the trends you want to see in the next few years? One of them is, like, I want to see about how Missouri deals with race relations. I want to see if the Missouri Democratic Party comes back as a viable party, which right now not looking good. But one of the things I said too is I want to see what happens with rural Missouri. I'm a suburbanite. I live in Richmond Heights. I'm from suburban Chicago. But, you know, my grandmother's from Ponca City, Oklahoma. My grandpa was born in Monroe, Iowa. I care about rural Missouri just as I much care about urban Missouri. And I'm sure you've traveled around parts of rural Missouri. It's not all poverty-stricken, like Cape Girardeau's doing really well, other places too, but some places have a lot of real challenges that require a lot of complex solutions. So in this 200th anniversary, what do you want to see to make sure rural Missouri has the same opportunities as urban Missouri to thrive in the next 100 or 200 years?
Probably the biggest thing there, Jason, is a shot at education.
Yeah.
I think when you really look at the Boot Hill of Missouri, if you look at some of the remote very counties in southwest Missouri, you want them to give an opportunity to make sure those kids get an education. That starts with early childhood development and then get them into the workforce. I think those are the two things that you move a needle on that. You know, the other thing, and you mentioned here, and I get stuck with mentioning it too sometimes, Missouri is so special because you have the urban and rural areas. That's what makes this state so great. It's why we're so diverse. And that's okay because of those two things. It's all right to live that lifestyle in rural Missouri versus to live in the urban areas. But I think the one thing, sometimes we divide our state because we want to divide it into those two categories, which I just think both of them have a unique value to this state, and you got to understand that. And for people like me as governor coming from rural Missouri, I need to be going around and says, hey, let me tell you about St. Louis and Kansas City, what the impact they have in our state, what the economic impact is, the challenges they have, and we need to help with that sometimes.
So I'm going to do a lightning round, and then I will be out of your hair.
Okay.
What did you think of the world's largest goose?
Well, I didn't know it was there to start off with, so it was a new experience for me. So Maxie, 64 feet long, had no idea an artist from Kansas City did it and did not realize it was the largest in the world. So there we go.
Who do you think is the better dog, Old Drum or Jim the Wonder Dog?
Where are we going to next week? Which can it? Is Jim the Wonder Dog? Okay, I think I'm going there next week.
Oh, my gosh. You just upset everybody in Johnson County. But it's true. Jim the Wonder Dog could travel back in time and save us from ourselves.
No, I want to answer that for you. I want to be serious about it. I want to answer that. I have some friends that support one dog, and I have some friends that support the other dog. I support my friends.
Okay, fair enough. Who do you think the greatest Missourian who has ever lived was, besides Brandon Todd Rosenbaum?
The greatest Missourian that ever lived. My gosh, that's a multiple of answers I think you have. As I'm starting to bicentennial, I think we've got so many unique characters. I'd hate to name one. But I think, you know, I think the Walt Disney's of the world had a huge impact on society. I think General Pershing being the highest ranking military officer in our state was huge. I think there's so many. You know, I guess for me on a personal level, I would probably say, and I would hope many people would talk about their dads and their moms and having been a huge impact on their grandparents of who we are. So,
you know, both of my parents are Missourians. Oh, this is a big question.
So your parents were smarter than you.
Yeah, this is
okay,
my question.
I just want to clarify.
This is my question. I asked this to Senator McCaskill. I moved here by choice when I was 18. I've lived here for more than half my life. Am I a Missourian or am I an Illinoisian?
Well, you still got a ways to go.
Oh, my gosh. This is important. I want to make sure if my kids are fourth-generation Missourians or fifth-generation Missourians, Governor.
Keep working on it, Jason.
Who do you think the great, besides yourself, obviously, who do you think the greatest governor of the state was?
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I think I just had to come to the first Capitol. up there. I think McNair had some qualities of. There's lots of governors back
is
there.
Is that Benjamin Gatz Brown right there? I think it is.
It is?
Yeah, he was a good governor. I think Lloyd Stark, by going after the Pendergast machine, was good. I think Hearns and Donnelly both made big changes to state government, too.
You know what? I always got a guy that, he's, of course, he's still alive, and you can go back to the history of the state, but I think Kit Bond was just a great statesman all the way around. I think all the way from his time he spent here all the way to Washington, D.C., I just think he had that act to him that he could bring people together.
Final question. Who is the greatest athlete who played for a Missouri sports team?
A Missouri sports team. Gosh, I don't. Well, I'd have to say Andy Reid in my era.
Yeah.
He was at MU, and look where he's at today.
My favorite my favorite Kansas City Chief of all time is Priest Holmes. I loved watching Priest Holmes. I know Patrick Mahomes is going to be number one for many people. I also really appreciate what Albert Pujols did for the state.
Priest Holmes, when he played for the Kansas City Chief, you want to talk about a guy that carried the load. Somebody like him. So I would have to put him up there on the top of it, too, that did it. I think there's so many great Kansas City, Buck Buchanan, Lanier. I mean, you go to all these, Cherry, all these guys.
So thank you so much for your time, Governor, for all of our stories, stlpr.org. You can find me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. Find you on Twitter at Governor Parson Moe, I think.
That's correct.
And I got to ask you this. You have come up to me a couple of times and asked me about the NBA. Are you looking at my Twitter account during the day, Governor? Because that's the only way you could possibly know that.
You may be one of the very few that I even watch on the media front.
As Stephen Weber told me, governors, they're just like us. Thank you so much for your time, Governor.
Jason, thanks for being here today. Appreciate it.
Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.